If you used a touchscreen today, or unlocked your car without touching it, or started your car without sticking the key in the ignition, you probably used the technology of inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip. We continue with the third broadcast with Hal Philip today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
We've been talking with inventor and entrepreneur Hal Philip and how he has generated technology that has attracted the attention of General Electric, Ford Motor Company, and we will eventually get to how it attracted the attention of Apple Computers. And so his technology is really cool stuff, had a lot of interest which was generated. And one of the big things that we want to talk about and get to eventually is his use of capacitive sensing in touchscreen technology. So this, by the way, is the third series of broadcasts. So if you haven't listened to the first two, please go back and listen to the first two, because that'll give you a good foundation and a good understanding of what we're going to talk about today. So, Hal, we were talking about all sorts of things, but I wanted to get to the idea of the touchscreen. As documented in your patents, you made touchscreens robust and affordable. But you weren't the first to propose a touchscreen. It's actually a pretty old idea that you honed to perfection. What's the history and the background of touchscreens, which I'm sure you know, because you had to do research in order to do the patents, right?
Yeah, I went back through the patent literature quite a long ways, and it started out somewhere back in the 1920s where people were doing two-dimensional sensing. I'm not exactly sure what they were using it for back then, but the idea was to use some kind of capacitive sensor technology to sense multiple points on a plane, and by sensing these points on a plane, you can define where somebody is touching. So it's usually the four corners of that plane. Like if you took a sheet of paper, you would connect up an electrode to one of the four corners. And with CRT technology and radar and so on, this technology became useful in certain military applications later on, and evolved to the point where it became cheap enough that in the 1970s and 80s, I would say, it became used on ATM machines and other applications, airport ticketing kiosks and so on and so forth. But these were pretty expensive methods of sensing still. You really couldn't reduce them down to the size and cost effectiveness of something that would work in a phone. But they did work. They were based on using a capacitive layer made of indium tin oxide, which is
okay,
rare.
Okay, that's India?
Indium. Indium is the...
Okay, it's a chemical.
It's a metal.
Okay,
it's a metal.
Okay.
Yeah. Indium and tin are metals, and the oxide thereof forms a semi-transparent layer, mostly transparent layer, which if it's deposited on a sheet of glass is conductive, but you can still see through it. And if you connect electrodes to the corners of the screen to this layer, then and connect those to a suitable electronic circuitry, you can sense where somebody is touching on that. But this required that this indium tin oxide layer be on the front surface of the glass. So basically, when you touch the screen, you're touching the indium tin oxide layer directly or maybe through a very thin insulating layer. And the problem with this was that it was very difficult to do the sensing. The sensing circuitry was very expensive. And also, it was very easy to damage. So if you had a ring on your finger and you grazed the surface of this screen with your ring, for example, a diamond ring or any kind of metal ring, you would create a scratch, and this would basically destroy the screen. So what was really useful would be to have the sensing layer on the back side of the glass as opposed to the front side of the glass. And also, these older technology sensors, touch screens, couldn't sense multiple fingers. They could only sense one at a time. And so if you could do that to put the layer on the back of the screen and sense two or more fingers at the same time, that would be absolutely fabulous.
So what did you do to make touch screens cheap and reliable?
So going back to the business model, we had a business model of using standard off-the-shelf microcontrollers. These were very inexpensive because they were produced in very high quantity for all kinds of applications. We did the firmware that went inside these chips that made them into capacitive sensors. Back in the late 90s, 1990s, I had devised a way of sensing many, many points through a single chip, not just one point. And that was called a matrix sensor. I trademarked that as a Q-matrix. And basically, it has rows and columns of electrodes. And these rows and columns function to localize where your touch is on the screen. And the beauty of that is that you can have multiple touches. You can touch in several places at the same time, and it will discriminate them all perfectly.
Okay.
And then you can interpolate mathematically between these zones of crossovers to get very fine resolution. And that is the basis of the touchscreen as used today. And that was developed by myself.
And you patented these, right?
Yeah, I patented the underlying technology for this. We didn't, at first, the first application was just for the appliance industry, really, because the appliance people had like 50 buttons on a key panel on an oven or something, crazy number of buttons. And you just couldn't have a chip behind each one of these. It was just too expensive. So the first application was to be able to sense all of these 50 plus locations with one chip. And so we did that. But the extension of that is once you did that, it's pretty easy to create a touch screen out of it. That you can sense to an infinite resolution or nearly infinite resolution across the screen.
Okay. Now, some people think that when you get a patent, that solidly anchors your invention, and anybody that uses it is obligated to come and to pay you money. Your experience is that patents don't do this. What does a patent do?
Well, a patent is a license to sue. So if you have a patent, basically it gives you the right to sue somebody if they infringe on that patent or you think they're infringing on that patent. Unlike stealing a car, stealing a patent is not a criminal act. It's a civil act, and you have to proactively go out and sue somebody in civil court to assert your rights over that patent. And by the same token, the defendant in that case has the right to try to destroy your patent, to say it's invalid for various reasons. Maybe it was preceded by some prior patent or some prior technology or a prior academic article or whatever it was that anticipated it years before you're filing it, in which case you don't have a patent anymore. Your patent has been destroyed. So this is the risk of going to court because your opponent will try to knock your patent out. But it's not a criminal case. It's a purely civil case.
You know, this is one of the big problems. We have some of the larger giants, such as Apple, Google, and Microsoft, that have stables of lawyers. And many of these companies actually pursue the adaptation and the introduction of technology into their products without really paying attention to where the technology comes from. And their modus operandi is sue me, or if they are sued and it looks like they're going to lose, they say, we'll buy you out. We'll give you some money. I know from personal experience, I did some consulting at Microsoft. And the first thing we did is meet with the lawyers. The lawyers are incredibly important. In fact, Bill Gates' father was a Preston Ellison Gates. And one of the big successes of Microsoft was not due to its technology. Everything that Microsoft really, in my opinion, that they've done has actually been stolen, bought, or co-opted in some fashion. But I did some consulting for Microsoft. And my first day there, I sat down and it was with a bunch of lawyers. First half day. The first thing they said is when you consult for us, everything you do is owned by us. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. And then they said, we don't want you at all to look at any patents while you were doing your work. And I thought, why don't you want to look at patents? Well, it turns out if I looked at patents, and they were sued later on, and they showed that I knew that this technology had been implemented before, they could actually sue for punitive or extra damages. Whereas if I had accidentally recreated the technology, that wouldn't be the case. Hmm. So these companies are really dominated by high-priced lawyers that I think make smaller entrepreneurs, they put small entrepreneurs in a difficult place in terms of developing and marketing their patents. In fact, you related to me that there were a lot of people that actually swiped your patents in some sense or copied them. I'm actually doing some work now for a company and I said, don't patent your idea. It's for data mining. Because if somebody sees the patent, they're going to go out and they're going to duplicate it or change it a little bit to kind of work around the patent. The best thing to do would be to keep a trade secret, which is to keep it very close to your chest, keep your cards close to your chest, and not let everybody in the world know what you were doing. But you chose to patent, which was the proper thing to do, I think, in this technology. But you were plagiarized more than once. What happened there? This was such a revolutionary idea that you had a lot of people come and begin to plagiarize you?
Well, first, as a general comment, you're right. It's really a big boy's game. Patenting and licensing is for an area of great interest for major corporates. The entrepreneur trying to enter this game is faced with a veritable field of landmines in approaching the subject. There's so many traps you can fall into. But yes, in my case, I was copied by quite a few companies and individuals who saw a good thing and just saw an easy target and thought that I didn't have the money to pursue them. And they were both large and small, but some very surprising ones. One was a professor from MIT who decided to write a paper on my technology and claim it as his own. That wasn't a commercial use, but it was really very unethical, in my opinion. And in other cases, a major defense contractor.
Well, actually, you appealed this to IEEE.
I did. I went to IEEE and appealed it, and they didn't give me the time of day.
They didn't give you the time of day. I'm a member of IEEE. If you don't know, IEEE stands for Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, largest professional society in the world with like 420,000 members. I mean, it's humongous. But like many organizations, what they do is not make decisions in terms of fairness. They make decisions in order to maintain the peace. And I think that you were the recipient of
Yes, but they actually had an ethics officer, and the ethics officer did nothing.
Okay.
The response was, it's MIT, so what do you do? It's MIT. You're going to attack an MIT professor or some no-name guy working out of his shed in England.
Really? Yeah.
It's just the way...
It's a David and Goliath thing.
It's the way the power structures lie, so I didn't have a chance. But anyway, that wasn't the worst of it. I was also copied by a major U.S. defense contractor. I was copied by a Canadian company that did automotive equipment, a major tier one automotive supplier who supplied to General Motors, Ford, and other companies. I was copied by Apple. It was public domain, as everybody knows about it because of the lawsuit.
Yeah.
So, Apple did quite a bit of copying of my stuff. Interestingly enough, the most ethical companies that I encountered were Korean companies, Chinese companies.
Koreans and Chinese,
yes,
really?
Chinese companies. English companies were okay too, but the Germans were right up there with ripping me off. I had some real problems with the German companies. But I did very good ethical business with the Koreans. American companies, they were really hell-bent on stealing stuff.
My goodness.
I wouldn't say as a general rule, but that there were a lot of them.
It was kind of the attitude that, neener, 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 what are you going to do about it?
Well, as my attorney in the Apple case said to me, it's don't take it personal, Hal. They just want to do business, and they want to do it the most economical way possible. And if they think that stealing your patent is going to get them further down the road, they will. They do it to everybody, not just you.
I was once contacted on the phone by some attorneys, and I found out they were patent trolls. And decided not to pursue any relationship with them. You are also affected by patent trolls. What's the story there?
Yeah, there was a company in Michigan, actually headed by a guy who was a lawyer, strangely enough, or maybe not so strangely enough. And he had acquired a portfolio of capacitive sensing patents that went back quite a ways. Some of them were about to expire. But he was going around in the industry bludgeoning companies to pony up money. Otherwise, he would sue them. And he would actually sue the companies, and it was really just a shakedown. I looked at the patents, and they were garbage. There was nothing there.
Yeah.
And didn't apply to anything that any of these victims of his were involved in.
But I tell you.
But just to settle the case and to get it out of their hair. And one of the victims was General Electric, oddly enough.
Oh.
Yeah, because they were a customer of mine, but they were also using an older capacitive technology from another company. And on the basis of that, this guy was going after GE. And I looked at the patents, and it was just, as I said, it was a garbage case. But GE didn't even blink. They just paid the money.
Is that right?
Yeah, they just paid the money.
So it's almost blackmail.
It was what kind of blackmail, yeah. They just paid the money. They just didn't want trouble.
And what was your response?
I stood up to the guy. I mean, he came after me too, ultimately. And so
what did he say? He said, I found a patent that makes your patent no good, or...
No, the basic idea is he has technology he claims precedes mine, and therefore I have to buy a license to it and pay him money.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, and no merit to the case. The merits have nothing to do with it. It's a pure shakedown attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tried that on me, but on the basis of some letters that he wrote to me shaking me down before he filed a lawsuit, I went to an attorney in Pittsburgh. Now, he wasn't in Pittsburgh. He was in Michigan. But I went to an attorney in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I said, here are these letters. I know for a fact that he's done business in Pennsylvania. Can we not file suit against him with counterclaims and drag his case into Pennsylvania. This way, he has to pay Pennsylvania lawyers. He can't be using his own lawyers, who are getting a percent royalty off of, a percent commission off of his blackmail activities.
That was probably the lawyers that contacted me. They were working on a percentage.
They're working on a percentage, yeah. Okay. So if you can get it out of their jurisdiction, it's great because for you, because it means that he has to suddenly pony up real cash to defend his position. And so in the end, we came to an amicable settlement. Absolutely nothing.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But it did cost you some attorney fees.
Attorney fees. But if you let these people get away with it, you'll attract other people that'll do it too. You become an easy mark.
It's like the U.S. saying that they won't negotiate with terrorists because it will escalate. It's the same sort of principle.
Yeah, you become a soft touch, known as a soft touch, and everybody comes after you. Okay. You have to be known as tough. Hey, if you're going to play in the heat of the kitchen called patents and licensing, you have to be able to withstand that. You have to be covered in Teflon and asbestos and everything else. Otherwise, just get out of the kitchen. Okay. You have to be tough as nails, and you have to vigorously oppose these people. Otherwise, other people get ideas.
That is just fascinating. You know, we haven't even got to the touchscreen technology, nor Hal's interface with Apple computers and actually a lawsuit which resulted from that. And we'll touch on that, no pun intended, next time on Mind Matters. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.